Hello and welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns and my guest today is an expert on long distance walking, on what they call these days, I guess, through hiking. He's also knowledgeable about equipment, about the kind of equipment you use, about being as light as possible. And he's an outdoor author and writer, and he also has the very unenviable task of being my editor. So I'm going to introduce today Alex Roddy. Hi, Alex. How are you?
Hi, John. I'm very well, thanks.
Good, good. Now, you've just published this, what I have to say is a massive tome. You wouldn't want to be carrying about in your rucksack, Wanderlust Europe, which is a guide to some of the best long-distance hikes in Europe. Tell us a little bit about the book. How did this come about, and what was it designed for?
Sure. Well, I mean, Wanderlust Europe is basically it's a coffee table book. It's almost a compendium of Europe's best hikes, which is quite a difficult thing to pin down, really. But it's a book that we created in collaboration with the German publisher Gestalten. They approached me late last year and just said, you know, we're creating a new title in the Wanderlust series. There'd previously been two titles, The Hidden Tracks and Wanderlust USA, both by Cam Honan, a very experienced long-distance hiker. And they invited me to work on the one that was focused on Europe. Right. So the result is this lovely coffee table book, very, very rich photography. We've had contributions from many, many photographers. And it just includes a huge variety of trails. We've got 30 individual hikes that have been made up into full chapters, and then a number of others that are just kind of listed as bonus hikes. And there's hikes from Western Europe, Eastern Europe, Northern Europe, Southern Europe, and Central Europe, even Iceland as well.
Yeah, I noticed that. So it's, what sort of length of these hikes? What are these, like the ones that you pulled out as like the best hikes from each country, or what sort of category? Or what's not category is not the word. What made you select these hikes?
Well, I think we were really looking for kind of quality and variety, so that there wasn't really any particular criterion that was kind of required, but we were looking for kind of the sweet spot between very good hikes and ones that perhaps weren't the best known but deserve to be well known. So there are some old classics, like the Pennine Way is very prominent, you know, the Cape Wrath Trail in Scotland, but there's also others that you probably will never have heard of. Was the GR57 in Belgium, for example. And you know, there's a number of kind of very wild, very long, very difficult trails, and there's others that are very accessible. So I guess we were looking for something for everyone, and kind of no matter your level as a hiker, there's going to be something in there that inspires you.
Right. So it's not exclusively for the hardened, seasoned hiker, then it's something that someone who's fairly new to long distance walking could also enjoy, is it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, not all of the routes are multi-week routes either. You know, there are some that only take 1 or 2 days to complete. There are some hikes actually listed in the bonus sections. So yeah, but definitely, if you're a beginner to long distance hiking, there will be routes in there that you'll be able to get excited about.
So what routes in there for you stand out?
Well, for me, because most of my experience has been in Scotland and in the European Alps, I would say, now it is very tricky to narrow down to just a few favourites, but I would say the Cape Wrath Trail has got to be up there, mostly because it was a kind of formative experience for me as a long distance hiker. I first hiked it 5 years ago, and it was my first really long route.
Before you go, there'll be people listening who don't know much about the Cape
Wrath Trail. Oh, sure, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about it. Describe it for us.
So the Cape Wrath Trail is a route about 250 miles long that kind of crosses the best and wildest landscapes in the West Highlands of Scotland between Fort William and Cape Wrath, which is the northwesternmost point of the UK mainland. And the kind of general idea is that it veers as far away from kind of roads and inhabited places as possible and just kind of plunges through all the vast mountain landscapes. And it really is pretty much the best long distance walk in the UK.
I'm right in thinking that, unlike the Pennine Way, there's not a specific rigid route. There are certain points you probably have to go through, but you can kind of find your own way. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So there are a number of variants that have become kind of established. So, for example, at the start, starting from Fort William, you've got a choice to make right away. You can either head west through Knoydart, which is the harder option, or you can go a long way up the Great Glen and then cut kind of west through Glen Affric towards Shiel Bridge. And there are other choices to make as well. So in the middle of the trail, there are a number of variants you can pick and choose. I mean, there are people who do the Kate Rath Trail multiple times and never go the same route twice. And, you know, you can look at a map and you can make up your own route. It's very informal. I think that's the good thing about it, to be honest. You can make it your own.
Well, that sounds really, it's certainly a great route. And what about some of the European routes that you've written about then? Any of those that particularly stand out for you that might be accessible for someone with a fair bit of experience, but probably perhaps not wanting to take on something really massive?
Sure. So Switzerland has got a place close to my heart. And in Switzerland, I've selected a couple of routes near Zermatt, which is a very popular in the south of the country. And Metalhorn is one of the few day hikes that I've listed that gets a chapter by itself. And Metalhorn is a peak about 3,400 meters high above the valley, and it's one of the best 3,000 meter peaks in that part of the Alps, in my opinion. It's really fantastic. I mean, it is a hard day if you want to do it in a day, but the views over the kind of big 4,000 meter peaks at the valley head are just spectacular. And also Tour of Monte Rosa as well.
Oh, yes.
That one starts and finishes in Zermatt too, and it kind of circumnavigates the Monte Rosa Massif. And you can do that in a week. It's tough, but it's not inaccessible to somebody who's, you know, done some Munros in Scotland and done a bit of long-distance walking. So I definitely recommend that one as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, it goes through some very, I know that sort of area, it goes through some very spectacular country, certainly. And the first peak you were talking about, that's not, you don't need to be a mountaineer to get up that. That's a hike, is it? Is that right?
Yes, it's a hike. I mean, there is a very small glacier at the top, but it's retreated massively over the last 10 years.
Right.
I mean, when I first climbed it in 2007, it was quite early in the season and we did need ice axe and crampons. There'd been a lot of fresh snow. But I went back there in 2017 and the glacier had retreated a long way. And particularly in high summer, you can get across it in trainers. I mean, there's a little bit of very mild kind of scrappy scrambling on the top, but it's decidedly a hike, not a mountaineering objective.
Oh, right. Okay. So that sounds really interesting. And so obviously, you know, and I know you've done a hell of a lot of long distance walking, but you can't have done all of these routes. So how was this book put together then?
Well, it was a collaborative effort, really. So you're right. I haven't done every single one of the routes in the book, but we got together with the people at Gestalten, the publishing company that published the book, and we kind of decided on this list between ourselves. And for a lot of them, it was a kind of in-depth research project. So great big piles of guidebooks.
Right.
And a lot of time spent poring over maps and kind of really getting into the details of all of these routes and also speaking to people who'd done them and looking at their photographs and kind of really immersing ourselves in the routes themselves. So it was kind of an exploration for me as well in many cases, and kind of putting myself into their shoes.
So it was in many ways a team effort then, was it?
Yeah, very, very much so. More than any other project I've done, I'd say. You know, we were always kind of communicating about the next section, and you know, and that goes for the photography as well. You know, I've supplied a lot of my own images for the book. But we've also had contributions from many, many photographers, including some that your audience might be familiar with, So we've got images from Chris Townsend, David Linton,
Michael
James Roddy as well, many others.
All the usual suspects there.
Yeah,
very good, very good. It sounds like there's been a fairly strong, well, I was going to say Scottish, but certainly British input into this book then. Apart from yourself, I mean.
Yes, there has. And I think that's reflected in the fact that there are several roots in Britain as well. So, I mean, I did have a degree of freedom when it came to kind of pointing the list in a certain direction. I did want to showcase roots in Scotland because I do love hiking in Scotland. Yeah. So I was glad to be able to put some of these routes forward.
Ah, that sounds great. But I mean, obviously, all guidebooks suffer from the problem that almost as soon as the ink's dry, they're starting to go out of date, aren't they? What's the and obviously, you know, I'm sure a lot of your books the book talks about huts and places to stay and all that sort of stuff. And all there's a massive challenge for all that kind of stuff with COVID-19 being about. So what do you think the role of a book like yours is right now? Well, we're facing, I think it's fair to say, an uncertain future, probably for the next few years, for the kind of routes that you've been talking about.
Yeah, this is something I've been thinking a lot about over the last few months, because, you know, I was writing it during lockdown, and even as I was writing it and conducting the research, thinking, you know, some of this material, it may well be out of date when the book's published. I mean, as you say, that is always
it's always the case.
But I think it's more so with this one, you know, that there's, for example, in the Scottish routes, I talk about Bothies, and as far as I'm aware, Bothies are still closed.
Yes, they are, yeah.
Yeah, and in Scandinavia as well, I don't know whether the Scandinavian wilderness huts are currently open. There will be, you know, many examples where it will tell you, you know, you can do this route in a particular way, and right now you can't do that. Mm-hmm. But I guess I see books like this as kind of almost like a touchstone of hope. So at the moment, you know, the world around us is quite a kind of dark and bleak place. You know, if you spend too much time looking at the news, sure. If you spend too much time on social media, it's easy to feel that the world is this kind of awful, dark place. But I think kind of coffee table books like this, filled with glorious pictures, filled with things to look forward to, they can be something to kind of hold on for, you know, maybe.
Yeah.
You can think that when the world is a little bit less crazy, you know, when we're able to travel again, maybe this is something that I'd like to go and do. You know, I'd like to think that's what it can do for people.
Yeah, it sounds to me, I mean, in some ways, it's a little bit like the kind of coffee table books that have been around, like, for example, Cold Climbs was a great inspiration to me. And it was, you know, I never actually managed to work my way through it, but there were things that I wanted to do. And as you say, you know, the thing is that I hope I can say with some certainty that we won't always be in this position.
Yeah.
You know, we are in a position that now, as you say, things are very limited, and it seems, you know, you can't find your way out of it, but, you know, there will be a way. A bit like writing my last book, you know, I couldn't find a way out of it, and then all of a sudden one popped up, and it all seemed so easy. I hope that's where we are now. There's also the case, though, that some of your routes actually are almost ideal for these conditions. In that, you know, obviously, if you can get to the start of them, you can backpack them with a tent, and there can be no greater social isolation than that.
Oh, yes, that's true. I mean, there has been a lot of debate about the kind of ethics of that kind of thing ever since COVID-19 really kicked off. You know, there are many people who do say that, you know, if once you're in the mountains, as you say, you're as social isolated as you can be. I think that the only concerns do come from when you inevitably have to interact with local communities, such as getting supplies and stuff. But, you know, we are adapting to COVID-19. Everyone knows rules now about mask wearing and social distancing. And I do think that you know, people will return to long distance backpacking. I know, for example, this year I was going to take part in the TGO Challenge, which is an annual backpacking event crossing Scotland from west to east. It's happened every year for 40 odd years now, and that was unfortunately cancelled this year. But as far as I know, it's going to go ahead next year. It may be a little bit different. I think social gatherings and so on are probably not going to happen. But you know, long distance walking will adapt, and people are not going to want to stay away from long distance walking forever.
Well, no, and I think it's very important that we kind of hang on to our ability to wild camper. There's been a lot of controversy, as you won't go into all that stuff about what wild camping is. And obviously, you know, Mountaineering Scotland have been pushing forward and pressing forward with their considerate camping campaign. So it seems to me that I guess, like everything else, camping might have to. On those sort of long distance hikes might have to adapt a bit, but I would hope that you know, a guidebook like yours can show us how we can still continue to enjoy some of these trails.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think, you know, really my main concern is in areas where wild camping is not allowed, or where the legal situation is very murky. I suspect COVID-19 is going to make it murkier. So in some of the European countries where I've highlighted routes, for example, in the Dolomites, wild camping is really not allowed. I mean, some people do stealth camp, but it's more frowned upon there than it is, for example, in the Lake District. And so there are routes where previously you could only really do it with the aid of mountain huts. And if those huts are closed, then it does. I mean, how will those routes be done in the future? We don't really know yet.
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, presumably, I can remember you and I have both been in alpine huts where you're crammed in shoulder to shoulder, doesn't cover it really. Sometimes layers deep, and obviously that kind of thing that opens up a whole can of worms for how some of these routes are done in the future. Sorry, and perhaps, you know, maybe those countries are going to have to put in some sort of infrastructure, as is talked about in Scotland, really, to cope with the numbers of people who want to use our outdoors and should be able to use our outdoors, really.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, I think about this in areas such as the Pyrenees. So last year I hiked the Haut Route Pyrenees from west to east. And although I didn't actually stay in any huts because I prefer wild camping, I did stop off in a lot of huts just for a meal or just to shelter from a thunderstorm. Uh-huh. And I can think of one occasion when there was a big thunderstorm over the Vignemale Massif, and dozens of people crammed into the entrance lobby of one hut, kind of shoulder to shoulder, just to get out of the rain. And last I heard, even the Pyrenees huts that were opening, they were strictly on a bookings only system, and you weren't allowed to just kind of drop in take refuge from the storm. So even that kind of thing, it kind of subtly changes the experience, you know. For example, thunderstorms become a bit more serious than they were before because, you know, you can't just rock up in the nearest hut. So people will have to take the changes seriously, I think.
Yeah, it's very difficult. I mean, you know, what are people going to do if the weather's horrendous and people want to come in? You know, I don't know how you work with that. As you say, at the moment, Boffies are still closed, and they're obviously, you know, they play a pretty pivotal role, particularly in the Cape Roth Trail, things like that. But it is possible, although it's a bit more hard work, I suppose, to cart your tent with you. And to complete those routes without having to use a bothy, is that right?
Oh yes, I mean you could complete the Cape Wrath Trail purely wild camping, and many people do. I think with that specific trail, the main challenge is that often it's surprisingly difficult to actually find somewhere to camp. Yes. So a lot of the ground in Scotland, as you know, is too kind of lumpy or wet. You know, just to find somewhere to camp. So I have made extensive use of bothies before, and I think if you can't stay in bothies, it will make the experience more challenging overall.
Yeah, I think so. You probably end up carrying a bit more weight as well, you know. And of course, you'd be more exposed to the tender mercies of the Highland Midge.
Which is
a barrier whose consequence cannot be overestimated, I think. Yeah. Certainly this year. Oh, there's been some wild midge experiences this year. So obviously, Alex, you've been writing for quite some time now. You started out writing in a lot of different places, but for one, what you've been a massive contributor to TGO magazine and other magazines indeed. And are you working on anything right now? Now that you've completed this project of the Wanderlust Europe.
Well, it's been a big year for writing, actually. I mean, since last year, I've also been working on a non-fiction book called The Farthest Shore, which I recently submitted to my publishers, Vertebrate Publishing, who also publish your books.
Yeah, they do indeed.
And that has been my kind of labour of love over the last year. It's the story of my 2019 winter Cape Wrath Trail, or at least winter-ish.
Oh, right, yes.
One of the themes of the book is that early 2019, there was a spell of very good winter weather, and then it abruptly vanished pretty much just before I started my route. So I wanted it to be a winter route. You know, I was prepared for full winter conditions, and it just didn't really happen. You know, it was kind of just a soggy summer route, really. So that's my book about that journey. And part of the deal with that journey as well is I wanted to use it as a kind of a time out from the internet, because I've kind of long struggled with the kind of constant noise of the internet, and you know, the constant notifications, the constant emails, and I'd formed this theory that it was contributing towards my anxiety. So I decided, well, I will completely step away from the internet for the entire period it takes to hike the trail. And the book is partly about that journey as well. So a parallel journey to the actual hiking experience.
And how was that for you then? I mean, obviously, I find it increasingly in wild places and bothies, there's still internet access creeps in, you know? And certainly, one of the things I also find, I often go, like yourself, to places where there's no internet access and you can't be contacted. But the world doesn't seem to accept that these days. Mm. If you tell someone, I'm going to be off-grid and uncontactable 3 days, people don't really understand that concept. How did you find it?
Well, it's kind of, it wasn't quite how I expected. So but to begin with, it is, of course, an artificial experiment, because as you say, the internet is encroaching more and more into wild places. You know, it's possible to get phone signal everywhere. And we all carry around smartphones these days. And in order to disconnect myself from the internet, I had to basically delve into the phone settings and deactivate the ability to go online, but still keep kind of general connectivity, because obviously hiking a trail like that in winter, your safety margin is reduced. So I didn't want to put myself at risk. So there's always a kind of an artificial aspect to it. And I was also carrying a satellite tracker as well on review for TGO. So the kind of artificiality of it was a very interesting aspect. And also, to be perfectly honest, after a few days, after a week or so, I kind of forgot that the internet even existed.
Very good.
Yeah, it was almost quite interesting to see how little an impact it made. And by the end of the trip, I was feeling a lot more positive about everything I do online. So I have this kind of love-hate relationship with Twitter. And by the end of it, I'd kind of made my peace with Twitter, to be perfectly honest. I mean, I still have to step away from it every now and again. Yeah. But it was almost like it just gave me the period of downtime I needed to sort out a few things in my head. So it was worthwhile, but it didn't quite go how I expected it to go.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things about social media is fantastic. It allows you to do all kinds of stuff. But it also, if you're not careful, dominates your life. And dominates, I mean, perhaps those of us who go to the outdoors have a balance there that people who don't go to such wild places don't have, because I do think, you know, being out in the hills sort of grounds you, and you realize that actually what someone says about your book on on Amazon is not probably the most important thing when you're actually trying to find somewhere to get out of the rain and have something to eat and maybe spend the night somewhere. That's much more important, really, isn't it? Did you think there was an aspect of that to it?
Oh, definitely. I think, you know, long distance walking, it's almost like an emulation of a much more primitive way of life. It's almost like we're kind of pretending to be Stone Age humans, because this is how people lived in the Paleolithic. You know, they moved through the landscape, and lived in the landscape. They were part of nature rather than apart from it. And I do think that if you're kind of permanently connected, you almost forget that. And I do believe that it is very important to be disconnected every now and again, just to restore that sense of perspective. And as you say, you know, if you spend time outdoors, you are more likely to have spells in which you're uncontactable and spells in which perspective just get a bit restored. And it certainly helps me to think, you know, I spend an hour and a half every morning just walking with my phone turned off, and it kind of grounds me, I think.
Mm-hmm. I think I'm sure that's right. I mean, I understand you're quite right that doing that today with the technology we have available is an artificial thing to do.
Yeah.
But it may be that I feel personally that there is probably part of us that actually needs that kind of connection with wild places. In that, you know, as you say, if you think about it, throughout we have evolved to be part of a natural landscape. And it's only the last 300 years or so, you know, since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, that many of us have moved away from that. And so my feeling is that actually, although it's artificial, it's actually really significant and really important. And I think a lot of people who go to the outdoors sort of, you know, that's the way they feel about it. Does anything like that feel true to yourself?
Oh, I agree. Yes. I mean, that's kind of one of the contradictions I work through in the book. You know, the fact that this long period of disconnection was artificial, but it also felt so valuable as well. And yet, interestingly, didn't work out the way I expected. It's a knotty sort of problem, really. And I think the fact that it is an artificial exercise, disconnecting from the internet, is also a little bit of a warning sign, because I don't think it should be an artificial exercise. My personal view is that there should be places and spaces where we can be completely offline and unconnected, but that isn't what the world wants. As you say, you know, the world expects us to be permanently connected.
Exactly.
And I don't think that's really good for us.
Well, they can't sell you anything if you're disconnected from the internet.
Yeah, but at the same time, there's always that balance between that side of it and the kind of safety aspect.
Yeah.
Nobody would want you to take away the ability to make emergency phone calls, for example. So it's a really fine balance, and there's not really a right or wrong answer or a right or wrong way of looking at it.
No, I think, you know, it's quite a complex question.
How
we manage technology. And I think
the trick is to be intentional about it. That's what I really learned. Just be intentional. You know, don't just be online all the time because that's what the world expects.
Sure.
Try and take control over it, difficult as that can be.
Well, that's right, and it's frightening. I mean, you know, I think I wrote a couple of stories once. I wrote one about Google Bothy, where a little robot enters a Bothy, and I also wrote one about somebody. I can't remember exactly what book it was even now. About someone being rescued by a drone that arrived on a mountainside and asked for his credit card details before they could do anything.
I think Bothy Tales as well, wasn't it? Maybe
Bothy Tales as well. Probably was. You'd probably have a better idea than me. but the truth is, actually, that was fiction. It's pretty close.
Yeah.
it's not far off, you know.
It's not far.
So your book, your next book, when is that due to be published?
That's due to be published next year. I don't think we have an exact publication date yet, but Vertebrate are going to be working their magic on it, and it's due to come out next year at some point.
Oh, right. Well, we'll certainly look forward to that. It sounds really great. And And your book, Wander. So if we're going back to Wanderlust, your book is about some of the. Let's hope that one day we will get back to being able to have the freedom to do these trails. I'm sure we will, and this book will I hope provide people with a lot of inspiration. Where do you think your writing will take you next? Have you any ideas? Where do you think you're going next?
Well, that's a tricky question, because, you know, I am getting out into the mountains a lot less. I live in Lincolnshire, which is a long way away from the hills.
Yeah.
This year, I've only really had two trips north. I mean, they've been good trips, but, you know, I think it's possible that my outdoor writing will evolve. I think I will be doing fewer of my kind of traditional outdoor features that I've been doing, simply because it's going to be more difficult to go and do them.
Yeah.
So I think, to be honest, I may be moving slightly more in the direction of nature writing. I've been
right.
Yeah. Like, during lockdown, I spent a lot of time kind of exploring my local nature and wildlife, and doing a lot more wildlife photography. And I can see my writing gradually shifting in that area. Not entirely, because of course nature and what we call the outdoors are inextricably linked. I don't think they should be separated. But I think one of the things that this year has really taught me is that you don't necessarily have to go to the mountains to find that sense of connection with nature that you referred to earlier. It can be found more or less anywhere. You just have to notice it.
I think that's very true. I mean, during lockdown, I was walking along the River Ness, because there was during that period that you couldn't go more than 5 miles from home.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. I think probably the drop in traffic brought this on a bit, but the wildlife that I saw, the birds that seemed to have taken the opportunity to take over part of the world, really.
Yeah.
There were ducks asleep in the middle of the road. You know, it doesn't take long for nature to come back to us.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I'm sure. Let's hope we'll. It's all about balance, I guess, isn't it? And I suppose what you're talking about is in terms of the internet and in terms of our social media lives and our natural lives, about finding some sort of balance there, really.
Absolutely.
But I hope, thanks very much for talking to me about Wanderlust. Been fascinating
Welcome.
Talking to you, and I really wish you all the very best with your future writing. And I'm sure you'll find a way of developing your career in the future. Thanks very much, Alex.
Thanks a lot, John. Thanks for having me.
Well, that was Alex Roddy talking about his new book that he co-edited. I believe it was a massive task. I think it was a whole squad to produce it. It's called Wanderlust Europe, and I'm sure you can get it from all very large bookshops, because it is a very large book. Another little book I wanted to talk about. It's actually quite a small book, I suppose. You meet people in the strangest places in the Highlands, and I think I met this bloke. I met Harry Churchill. I think he was playing the bugle outside of the Ozone Layer Cafe up at Cape Roth. That's why somebody's got to do it, haven't they? And he's a ghillie, which is, I suppose, fairly close to it. It's like a Highland gamekeeper, not quite a gamekeeper, or the equivalent of a gamekeeper, but so I've met him in various desolate spots across the Highlands by some strange freak. And he's produced a little book. It's called The Highland Ghillie's Diary. And it's exactly that. It's a diary of his life over 7 months, working on estates on the West Coast, and assisting with deer stalking and all the other duties that he does. And although, obviously, as you'll understand, I don't really, I don't have a lot of sympathy with deer stalking. In fact, I'm pretty much against it, really. But you know, it's nevertheless an aspect of Highland life, and it's an insight really into what is a way of life that's actually dying out right now. So if you're interested, it's well written and it's quite interesting in its way. And it's only £1, I should say that. So I'll put a link to Harry Churchill's little book on the website for this page, and you could do a lot worse than spend your pound and read about Harry's life in the Highlands. So coming up on Outside In, I've had a fascinating discussion with polar explorer Ash Roughton. So if you want to find out what it's like to trek for days and days and days across a frozen lake in Russia, or freeze to death in pretty well a lot of other inhospitable environments, then do listen to Ash Roughton's podcast. It's very informative and really interesting. I do hope you've enjoyed Outside In. I've been John Burns as usual, and do come and see me again. Thanks very much for listening. Bye bye.